Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. My guest today is the cherished English poet, broadcaster, children's author and playwright, affectionately nicknamed both the godfather of modern poetry and patron saint of poetry in general. He was one of the Liverpool poets alongside Brian Patton and the late Adrian Henry. Today, he's an OBE and CBE, the latest awarded for services to literature in 2004, Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and President of the Poetry Society. To all of us who love poetry, he remains one of the most familiar and delightfully gentle voices on BBC Radio 4 as the long-standing presenter of Poetry Please. He is, of course, Roger McGough. Roger, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
It's nice to be here. And also, I was the Oldie Poet of the Year.
Of course you were.
Yes.
Now, Roger, before we get on to your magnificent new anthology, can we go back to the beginning? Mm-hmm. You grew up in Liverpool, yes, in an Irish Catholic family.
Indeed.
And then went to university at Hull, where Philip Larkin was librarian, to read French and geography. Now, you'd already won awards as a child for reading poetry aloud, I think particularly for reading Lewis Carroll's Jabberwocky. But it wasn't till Hull that you wrote your first poem, or was that just the first poem to be published?
No, probably my first started writing when I was went to Hull. I went up when I was 17, not being very interested in knowing much about poetry, really, except at school, having recited on stage. Because my mum had sent me to elocution lessons to, uh-huh, you know, okay, with this liberal accent, like, Roger, if you want to get on, you got to speak nice. So went for this elocution in the school. And one of the things they did, it was quite popular in those days, and which is a good thing, is that reading aloud in class, getting the class to recite poetry, you know, from juniors, from nursery rhymes right up until half a league onward. And even though I never often understood the poetry we had to study, I wasn't over keen on Shakespeare, wasn't taught very well, really. But the idea of standing on stage and reciting, I like that. But I didn't see it as literature, it was just something that you did. So when I went to Hull, I failed English Lit O-level.
Did you?
I did, I know. Because I realise now, you got to read books, actually, to get through.
I want to come back to that failing your English Lit O-level later. But let's go on with why you wrote your first poem and what was it about?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Having done French at uni and then reading some of the poets like Rimbaud and Baudelaire and de Nerval. It was also, I think, to be honest, the lives that they lived, you know, these outliers, these rebels, a bit naughty. And that was a nice idea. I'd also, when I was younger, always wanted to, I like drawing, like painting, and I always wanted to do that. But at school, you're told you're not quite good enough, you're not as good as, you can't draw a cabbage as good as Chauncey, you know, so don't bother. And also from a parent's, you know, why pursue something that, where will it lead to? And you've got to be very good to be, you know what I mean? Whereas poetry was secret.
Secret, how interesting.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? You write something, it becomes very public, and yet you're quite secret. And even today, I always say whenever I go on stage to read poetry, you know, I like being on stage, but I don't like people looking at me.
How interesting. Mm-hmm. Was Larkin in anywhere in influence? Were you aware of him being a poet then? Or?
Yes. We were in a small hall of residence called Needle Hall, and he just came in as the sub-warden. He was very friendly. I described him as a toppling steeple of tweed.
Toppling steeple of tweed, that's
well, wonderful. Well, rather brusque in that. But so I didn't talk to him. I wouldn't have known what to have said, Charlotte. So it was only, but towards my final year, when I'd written some poems, I sent them to him. And he was very encouraging, very nice, very warm.
Can we go back to the French for a minute? Because the last time you and I met was in Sheffield when your astonishingly good adaptation of Molière's La Maladie Imaginaire was playing at the theatre there. And it was absolutely fantastic. And more than that, you put it into verse, which you I then discovered, because it was so beautifully versed by you, that I'd forgotten that the original was actually not in verse, which you pointed out.
It was a mistake. I mean, I should have checked on that before I started. But, yeah.
But I'm so interested, because you were also then a French teacher later on when you met all your fellow collaborators on the scaffold and everything. Why French? Where on earth did that come from?
I don't know. I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I never went to France. So I was not enamoured to it, but I had a gift for the words.
I don't think anyone's going to have made a segue from Molière to Lily the Pink and the Scaffold, but I'm going to, because you did manage to get Lily the Pink into your fabulous adaptation of that play. So before we move on to the poetry, let's talk a bit about the Scaffold.
Yes, it was interesting. There's a lot going on in Liverpool. I'd come back, I'd just finished university, got back to Liverpool and got a flat or stay with friends in Liverpool while I was doing things, while I was getting teaching jobs. I taught in a comprehensive school in Kirby, and then I taught, quite interestingly, catering French in a college after that.
Catering French?
Catering French, yes.
Does that mean you're really good at French cookery?
I didn't say that. What it was, in fact, it was catering French. I got an assistant lecturer in catering French at Mabel Fletcher College.
Good Lord.
Of catering and and business and all sorts of things. And that was the job. During that time, I was then outside going into town, into Liverpool 8, where the clubs, and but there I met some people, Adrian, certainly Henry, first of all, then Brian. And then up to, remember Liverpool came, Michael Horowitz. Remember Michael Horowitz?
Michael Horowitz, Michael, indeed, yes.
Pete Brown, and they were doing their sort of poetry and jazz. We looked at that. We got started writing and then performing, and it was a very good time and easy place to find an audience to be in. One of the clubs would have an evening where it was closed, so we could hire it for nothing, next to nothing. And people came, and people, it was full of younger people, come along, students generally, but not only. Come along and enjoy the evening. You have poetry and some music, and loved it. So it was very, we encouraged each other, I think. Also, there was an influence, certainly, by what was going on, the Beats in America. But it seemed like a natural thing for us to do, and getting published out in London was difficult. You're writing your poems. The only magazines were in London, so that was difficult. So Brian Patton started a poem called Underdog, so we'd publish our own poems for our friends, in a way. That's what
it was. A magazine, Underdog, was it?
Underdog was a small mug, it was small. It didn't last, and it was good, and a lot of love went into it. But there's a lot of art going on. Everyone was a poet, and we'd have poetry readings and musicians. And I then started writing sketches, and I was writing Inesco and surreal type of stuff, dialogues mainly, so poetry in these. And then meet, like, John Gorman was a guy who came along, and he was a good organiser of things, and so we do sketches together. He was very funny, very good. Other people joined in, and then this chap turned up who apparently his brother was in a band.
Mike McCartney,
when we first did the show, his name was blank, because he wanted to use McCarthy. We didn't know who McCartney was. We honestly weren't most interested in him and the Beatles. Out of these sketches, and John writes sketches, and they became funny. They were satirical, beyond the fringy type thing. Mm-hmm. Surreal, very surreal, and remain surreal. So all the scaffold material. In fact, in April, the Cherry Red company introduced releasing a scaffold box set.
April, coming. How exciting.
Yeah, it's interesting, because all the songs are there, and also a lot of the sketches and the stuff that we did. And so there was never any music then. That came later when we started to do shows based on the poetry and the comedy. And then we'd maybe sing a song at the end, thank you very much for coming. One of Mike's songs, thank you very much for the entry, thank you. And then they developed in Brian Epstein. became our agent. Nothing to do with the fact that Mike McCartney was Paul's brother. But anyway, Brian Epstein became our manager. And then we started making records. And Tim Rice, as a young man, straight out of uni, he was working as a in the setup. So then we became songs, and people wanted the songs. Once you make it hit like Lily and Thank You Very Much and all these things, that's what a lot of people want.
Yes, you had a lot of top 20 hits, didn't you?
We did, yeah.
With The Scaffold.
Liverpool Lou and, you know, Live of Birds and stuff. Did you know that the reason people now can do decimalisation is because we introduced it to the nation, actually, on radio. We recorded all these jingles about how much, you know, 2p is worth now.
Can you do the jingles now?
No. I'm not very good at maths. No, didn't write the script.
I mean, what's interesting about Liverpool then is there were all sorts of people hanging around. It wasn't just the Beatles.
Yes, it was great stuff. Liverpool's great fun at that time. And then when we got into the recording studios, as we did, down in London, and that was interesting because you'd be in Abbey Road or you'd be in studios or some other studios making records, and there would be Keith Moon, come and pop in, someone that played drums, Graham Nash, really nice guy, Graham Nash, and but to be in the company of people like these really top musicians, you realise very quickly that you're not a musician, so you're part of the gang, you're all there, and in between tapes you're chatting away and you think, oh, I'm a musician, I think, until someone sits at a piano or picks up a guitar and you realise you ain't. So that was always going on. That was suddenly money coming in.
Can I just stop you there? Yeah, what do you mean you ain't? You realise you ain't? You don't think you're a musician?
Not. No, I can't play an instrument. I think I can. I can put melody together and sing when there's a knife pressing into my back. but in a sense, and I say this in the show, and I'm setting myself up rather, but when you're there, and I really admire them. But because I was the only one with a geography degree in the studio, and so they admired me for that, you know, because none of them had degrees really. Yeah. So they looked up to me. So at first there'd be things like, you know, what's the capital of Roger, what's the capital of Yugoslavia? Yeah, and I'd say, you know, Brussels or whatever. And they'd think, yeah.
Okay. They were delighted.
And so it went on. And so they looked up. So I was able then to give them help in a funny way.
Is it true though that you all hated the title of the Merseysound?
Adrian was happy with it. Brian, I didn't, because it seemed to be, you know, grabbing on the coattails. Of the Beatles, of Beatlemania, and the next thing comes out of Liverpool is that, and which is sort of true, but it worked as a
sure did,
it sure did, yeah, I mean, didn't it? Sure did, yeah, it did work.
Over a million copies sold,
indeed, yes, and it was good, and it, I know even now, you know, to meet people who found it, you know, accessible, I suppose, and poetry when I was young was other places. There's no poetry about Liverpool, and people are writing poems about walking through the misty headlands and seeing the daffodils floating and so on.
Wordsworth.
Without seeing a daffodil, I've never seen a daffodil. You know, these guys living like me, living near the docks in Liverpool. Now, it wasn't very romantic to write about that, the dock there, but it was truth. And you've got to find your own daffodils amongst the rubbish.
It's very interesting because you said at the beginning when we first started talking just now, you said that your first poem felt like a secret. But what was great about what you and Brian and Adrian did was you took it all over the place and performed. I came to see you several times, three of you performing, and it was such a great evening, and it was very far from being secret. And can we talk a bit about Alive and Kicking, because you are still... no, it's not called that. What is it?
Alive and Gigging.
Alive and Gigging.
Gigging, yes.
Alive and Gigging. Mm. Yes, because you're touring like mad at the moment still, aren't you? And went to Glastonbury. What was that like?
Glastonbury. It was exciting. Never been before. Came down with my wife and my sons came. He didn't stay with us. He went off join his mates.
And were you in a posh yurt?
Well, so that's all. You know,
we looked after.
Yeah. Well, I must say, it was, yes, because I had a children's play was up there and running as well, called The Sound Collector. That was rather nice. So that's one of the reasons I went to see that in fruition. And I did my couple of readings, which were nice, but yeah, it was great. You go into this huge tent and the audience are all sitting there on the floor waiting. And you start, and as soon as you start your first poem, which is a very tender ballad, as you can imagine, and then the Mexican 28-piece band walk past outside. Oh, Nigerian trumpeting. And so, you know, which puts you off, really.
Yes, and you famously do not have a loud, booming voice.
And I do not have a loud voice. But the good thing was, the audience didn't turn her, really. They're used to it, you know, so they're fine. But it was so crowded, and so everything so good. And the people were lovely. Every act was great. Everyone was talented so much. It was nice. But I was probably 40 years too late. Had I gone 40 years earlier, I think I'd have enjoyed it more.
So let's get on to talking about your fabulous new book. Now, I was reading about you doing an enormous amount of rewriting. Is a lot of this in here poems we've read before that have been rewritten? Is a lot of it new work, or is it just everything collected? Because it's a big old book.
It's a big old book.
Yeah.
As I was putting it together, you know, whether you put it in from the first poem that was published.
The first poem is about the pressure of holding a book in your hand. Oh, yes. Lovely first poem.
Yes, and obviously that wasn't the first poem I wrote. So no. Do you make these decisions? What do you start with? Do you grab them from the beginning, or do you start with your earliest poem you wrote when as a teenager? Is that the first poem you start with? Probably not. So I did a sort of poem about holding a book in your hand, but then it goes into my early memories. Mm-hmm. But then it moves quickly into sideways into whatever comes next and goes on, and then it goes up, and then you're in and out of love and but children, and then all the time sideways, what's going on in the world, attitudes, but as far as rewriting, it does give me a chance, because knowing these poems are all printed anyway in books, so if I think, this is better, I think this is a better rhyme, that's a bit sloppy, I can do it. It's my work, and if people don't like it, I say, who's going to
care? They can go back to the original.
They can go back to the original, but yeah. Mm. And who's going to care? You know, I'm constantly writing, anyway, even like today, before you came in, I was fiddling away.
What's your routine? Do you write every single day?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to say, I'll write a poem today, and what should I write about today? But I'm always thinking about the one that I left off.
And how much of it is love poetry?
It's all love poetry. Some of it, a lot of it is.
So you've been married twice, and I read somewhere you rewrote a lot about what you'd written about your first wife.
Some of it, yes, it wasn't about my first wife, and that was, you know, young, and it didn't work out, and it was painful. And you wrote about that. But sometimes, during that time of a breakup, I wrote about a man and a woman. And it wasn't me and him, maybe inspired by that, but certainly it didn't. What happened in the poems didn't happen in real life. And I did actually change a bit, because I found it too brutal.
Heartbreak is brutal.
Yeah. Mm. And that was shorter marriage, and since I've been married to Hilary for a long time, and to her children and a little grandchild, born on December the 29th. So lovely, Ariel. So that's it. Some of the love poems, less love poems love poems about our meeting, but she's always there, you know, she's almost every poem. And I'm just reminded about a poem here called Where's the Poem About My Mother? And because so many poems about, got so many uncles. My mum was one of 13.
No, 13.
God. So, and all the, when I was growing up, all the men were at war. They're all abroad in the Army, Navy.
They couldn't have all survived, did they?
None of them were killed, but they all survived. Badly survived. We spent time in prison war camps and things, and one in Japan, and they all came back. Not all, what luck came back with problems and drinking and things and all that. So it was a lot of my youth, my growing up rather, were my aunties, and they were funny, Gabby, jokey. They taught me a thing, taught me how to smoke, how to dance.
How old were you when they taught you how to smoke?
Oh, well, no, they didn't have a puppy. What's then? So a lot of aunties, and that was good. So that was fine. On my dad's side, very different. He had one of seven, many men, and they were all away. They had been away. And my grandmother was quite tough, my auntie. My grandfather... My father's dad, I don't know about him at all. Never met him. They didn't talk about him. There's a lot of
Did he die in the... In...
Don't think so. No,
you just didn't meet him?
Off. He just disappeared. Did or not. One of the things about it, and for me it's important, was I was always told how lucky I was. Boy. Almost goes around and say, oh, lucky Roger, lucky boy. Oh, Roger, don't forget, you're lucky to have a little sister called Brenda. Lucky. Lucky to have mum and dad who love you. Lucky to be born in Liverpool. Could have been born in Manchester, London, whatever that is. Yeah, no, you're lucky to be a Catholic, you know. And so, in a funny way, that sort of stays with you. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never actually, I don't know, I shouldn't say this, but you never quite envied people. Mm-hmm. I never think I should have been somewhere else. I've always thought, I'm lucky to be here, lucky. And I am.
I just want to go back to what you said at the beginning, which really, really strikes me. You said you didn't get an O-level in English literature. And I know you've said somewhere, and have been quoted on this, as saying that you think that people who go and get a fancy degree in English literature from Oxford and Cambridge, like I did, are so traumatised by the weight of the canon that they don't have the guts to try and sort of compete with it and take it on, that you were very liberated by not having sort of intellectually studied the canon. I'm really interested by that.
Yeah, because I remember talking just a few... last year, I met a chap at a reading and we were talking afterwards, and he was saying the same thing, that he loved poetry at Cambridge. But he did, was in his 50s before he sort of started to write it. And because he was there with Ted Hughes and people at the time, and you probably can't help comparing yourself with them and that. And so I did have that sort of rather nice innocence to get through it. And I mean, the poetry is there for you. You don't have to be, the poems that influenced me, I'd done it, listening to an album of Dylan Thomas at Hull University, listening to that really sparked me up.
Who was reading that? Was that being read by Burton?
It was read by Burton.
Well, that helps.
It just helped me, just exactly. I can believe what's he saying. It's very good. And then started reading that. And the first live poet I heard was Christopher Logue.
Yes.
That was a wonderful poet, as you know. And just hearing Christopher Logue reading poems he'd written, and I could understand it. It didn't keep me away.
That's the thing. It's accessibility of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think one of the problems with studying English literature is not only did we study the canon, but also we were taught practical criticism. So we could take a scalpel off to any piece of work, and of course that turned on ourselves.
Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. It was capable of destroying a lot of people's potential creativity, whereas you were free from all that.
I remember being trying to find for the last few months, but I came across a while ago a poem I'd written when I was at university, and it must have been my third year. My girlfriend and I went to Scarborough for the summer, and I got a job as a waiter. I remember. I enjoyed the week. And I wrote a poem about the waiter, which began, in between the tables, silver gleaming, I dash, full splash, soup plate steaming, and it goes on and on and on. And I remember finding it and then losing it again. But I was struck really by how, as I could have written it last week.
Yes.
It was, uppish and buoyant and very musical and good, some good rhymes in it, and surprising.
65 years ago, you probably
65
wrote that.
Years ago, yeah. And, you know, I could, and I'm, and improved. Feel like you could say that, couldn't you? You could say that, couldn't you? Either you had the gift from the beginning and you carried it on, and you honed it, or you haven't improved, mate.
Which brings us very neatly to the last poem in this book, because you said it was quite a new one.
Yes.
And it's absolutely beautiful, and I'd love you to end. Would you just read the first two verses?
Because
it sort of says it all about the state of the world we're in.
I was contacted by the Poetry Society, the book library in South Bank, and said that there was an exhibition of photographs from Ukraine, actually, in Liverpool, and what I wrote upon, perhaps to go with this. So I wrote upon his first two verses. Call me world, I am land. I'm happy for you to live on me, till and plough, graze your cattle. Build your homes upon me. I will feed, nourish, even bury you, but I'm not yours. Not yours to fight over, to invade and plunder, divide and destroy. I do not belong to you. Even though you claim me, I'm not yours. I have no name, flag or anthem. Call me world.
Oh, that's just beautiful. And it goes on, and it's absolutely... It's a wonderful poem. And it does sum up everything that's wrong with this sort of land grabbing that's going on all around us.
Yes, it is. Mm. Thank you.
And just last question. I know all our listeners will be desperate to know. Plans for poetry, please? You're not going anywhere soon?
I'm waiting now for to see what's happening in the next batch. Hopefully it will go on, you know.
With you at home?
Hopefully, but...
Hooray!
I don't say hopefully. It would be nice if it were. But I'm surprised. I've gone on so long. I'm surprised that I've been asked to come back and do it all the time. I love doing it, and I've learnt a lot from it. Life changes, things change, you know what I mean? And maybe you want someone who's more knows who these, some of the poems, poets. Some of the poets I haven't heard of until I hear they come up. Because, you know, it's so many poets out there, which is a great thing. Mm. I blame myself partly, but there's so many, too many poets. No, it's good. And so I learned a lot from doing it. I love it. I enjoy it. But there's so many voices out there wanting to be heard. And I hope there'll be new programmes doing it. It's finding ways of keeping young people particularly interested.
I know that you've been asked this a million times, and you don't ever like talking about your favourite poem or favourite poet. But I'll ask it another way then. Who have you discovered recently that you hadn't heard of that you thought was just wonderful?
Yes, again, it's a difficult one, because I don't know. I mean, I have to think about it. You know, there's not a quick answer to that. When people say, you know, which is your favourite poem, I would say, quoting Adrian Mitchell, I don't like to say it because the others get jealous. And that's that. People write to me still, ask me to read their book, and say something for the blurb. Mm-hmm. And I just have to say, I'm sorry, because... I get asked, and I don't want to choose. Mm-hmm. Don't choose you, and don't choose something. Well, it's not fair. You know, there's something good in everything. So that's all that I say, really. So there are lots of, I can name the people who, the Charles Causeleys, I really meant the Mitchells and all these people behind me. Norman McCaig, a lot of the Scottish poets influenced me, and but I'm not going to pin it down to one. We are. All writing one poem.
What a wonderful place to end. Roger, thank you so much for being on Radio Aldie. Loved having you.
Loved it. Thank you.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, talking to the godfather of modern poetry, Roger McGough, on Radio Aldie. If you've enjoyed listening and would like to hear more conversations like this, simply go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very warm thanks again to Roger McGough, to Bailey Gifford for supporting and sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. you've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.